Welcome back to the R Squared podcast. I'm Ian Levy. Today's guest is Nate Silver, the editor-in-chief of 538. Nate's here to talk about 538's Carmelo player projection system and the accompanying team win projections that are built off of those player projections. All right, Nate, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you, Ian. I was telling you earlier, I'm always busy this time of year. Like, every sport is happening pretty much, but that's fun. That's good for business.
Absolutely. So we've got you on today to talk about the basketball projection system that you guys just rolled out at 538, the Carmelo projection system. And wrapped up in there are individual player projections, and then those are cobbled together to build team win projections. So I wonder if you can start by just sort of the cliff notes on the projection system, how it works, and what variables the projections are based on.
So years ago, about 10 years ago, more than that, in fact, I designed a system called PECOTA for Baseball Prospectus, which it used historical comparables to predict current players. So, you know, the idea is you had some up-and-coming Cubs third baseman, maybe Chris Bryant or whatnot, and it would have, you know, Mike Schmidt and George Brett might be a comparable, but also Kevin Ory and Gary Scott and kind of failed Cubs third base prospects from the past, for example. It's the same idea Carmelo for basketball. We took every player since the merger in 1976, quantify him along like 18 different dimensions, which sounds like crazy, but it's all the kind of conventional advanced stats basically. And then find comparables for each player. So for example, the example we used, in the main article we wrote is John Wall is a guy where 25 years old next year is kind of an inflection point for a lot of guys' career. And you can see players like Isaiah Thomas, where you had, you know, Russell Westbrook, where things were good or kept getting better. Jason Kidd's a guy who's pretty comparable, but also Kenny Anderson, where kind of fell off a cliff, Steve Francis, Peak Durley, Darren Williams. So you get kind of a full range of outcomes for each player is the basic idea here.
Mm-hmm. And so then you use the career paths of those comparables to project how John Wall's career path is going to go. Is that right?
Exactly. And you get a confidence interval here. So he has some scenarios. He has like a 10% chance of being a 15-win player, not next year, the year after next, which is like an MVP candidate. But also, year after next, a 10% chance of being worth two wins or less probably means he's gotten hurt or something, or kind of tanked. But even though basketball, compared to baseball, compared to football or hockey, certainly, even though it seems like it's relatively predictable, you have large sample sizes and whatnot, you're still dealing with young men, young athletes, and a lot of different things can happen, positively and negatively. So kind of showing our work and showing the detail is kind of the idea here.
Mm-hmm. So the 18 or 19 variables that the players are compared on, how did you select those variables? How did you decide that those gave you the most accurate picture? And then they're in the article, you talk about how they're weighted because they're all sort of weighted differently. You know, height is weighted differently than weight and things like that. And how did you decide on the weights that sort of gave you the most accurate picture?
So doing the weights is a little bit kind of harkening back to the old Bill James baseball similarity scores, where he was just kind of saying, I'm going to pick some weights that intuitively seem about right. And that's kind of more or less what we did. And the reason for that is that if you go and try and optimize the weights and you run into problems called overfitting, which is that, you know, you're looking at a bunch of variables that are highly correlated and making very minor adjustments, and maybe not adding as much value as you think for a lot of work, and maybe for some confidence intervals that understate how much uncertainty there is. But basically we're saying, let's pick a way to compare players in a way that makes good intuitive basketball sense, really, and then just kind of see how it does. It's a very what you see is what you get kind of system where, you know, for the most part, the comparables are I think, past the smell test. Sometimes you find ones that are counterintuitive. You compare players from different eras. One thing I'm fascinated by is that when you hear a lot of comparisons about players on the radio or whatnot, very often like black guys compared to black guys and white guys to white guys, and Carmelo is race blind, right? So you have like, you know, Gordon Hayward and Andre Iguodala, things that you wouldn't think of intuitively, and those are kind of fun too. But yeah, it's, you know, basically 20% of the weight comes down to, I have this written down somewhere, right? 20% is shooting and scoring. 20% is the rest of players' offensive game, so ball handling. 20% is rebounds and defense. 20% is physical attributes, so height, weight, draft position, which is important for young players. If you are a number one pick, then you do have more upside that can be shown. It doesn't really help if you're like 30 or something, but if you're a guy who struggled in his first couple of seasons. And then playing time is kind of the last major category. So it sounds like a whole bunch of things, but it's really just kind of five major things if you think about it that way.
Mm-hmm. And considering how many different things there are to measure, it's more on the simple side. So I'm wondering about if you had any specific players who came out with like extremely low similarities. So players who were sort of extremely unique that it was difficult to find comparables for. The analogy I'd think of is Kendall Marshall. When he came out in the draft a couple years ago, the draft similarity scores or draft prospect similarity scores had a really hard time with him because there were sort of no historical draft prospects who shot as rarely as he did or passed as often as he did or had as high a turnover rate as he did. So were there some sort of odd fits there?
Yeah, so, I mean, some of the lowest scores belong to, like, 37-year-old players just because they're are guys dropping out of the database. But for guys who are in mid-career, Hassan Whiteside is a guy who has a really low comparability score. He's kind of either really great at everything or really terrible at everything. You know, Derrick Rose is an interesting one, because he's trying to match both playing time and all the stats, and so it's kind of like, I'm not quite sure what to make of Derrick Rose, really. Who's another guy who tends to be on the extreme end of either category, but with the interruption in his career, becomes a hard guy to fit perfectly. But still, one thing that surprises me a little bit is that, in general, it's kind of easier in the NBA than in baseball to group players into types, right? So you might have like a DeAndre Jordan type of player where, you know, Rudy Gobert fits there and Tyson Chandler. And it's not like you have a ton of examples of that player type, but you do have four or five, right? And so you always usually have something to go off. But yeah, someone like a Derrick Rose where you're dealing with a severe injury situation, where you're dealing with productivity in the past that isn't there in the present in a way that's unusual for a guy who should be in the prime of his career. Someone like that, like literally the little icon we give him is a shruggy, because for that case, you know, something like Carmelo is not going to be as useful as for a guy when you can identify, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 or 100 historical precedents that are pretty sound.
So it's interesting to hear you say that it's easier to group basketball players than baseball players, because there's sort of this dichotomy, right, between baseball and basketball statistics and this thing about, you know, baseball sort of being static and you have the pitcher versus the batter, and it's either easier to isolate things. You know, in basketball, we have this fluidity and five players playing off each other. And it's funny because my perspective would be that baseball players would be way easier to group into similarities. And maybe it's because I don't pay as much attention to baseball as basketball, but, you know, but you've got power hitters and you've got, you know, speed and you've got, you know, contact hitters and things like that.
No, for sure. But I think in basketball, you have more kind of distinct skills that you can measure, if that makes sense, right? Whereas in baseball, for example, something like plate discipline, people kind of loosely mean that to mean how many walks do you draw. Well, that's complicated because plate discipline is very much tied into how much power you have. If you're being pitched around a lot, then that's different. Whereas in basketball, you know, for better or worse, usage rate and true shooting percentage and you know, free throw percentage gives you a pretty good, you know, those three stats give you a pretty good dimensionality of kind of how a guy is offensively, and then, you know, rebound rate is what it is, and assist rate, and so, I mean, some of these things are team dependent, you know, and so we haven't tried for Carmelo to do what we did for Pekoda and team neutralize everything, right? We're not trying to account for boy, if you have a great point guard, if you have Chris Paul, does that improve your true shooting percentage? It probably does. But still, still, it's just kind of, it's more vivid. I don't know quite how to put it. If you look at the comparables again, there are some times where it misses or you kind of scratch your head and say, oh, that makes sense, or maybe it doesn't. But for some reason, profiling basketball players in this way seems to create a kind of richer image of what type of player they were, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. So the Carmelo model is very linear, and it doesn't take into account context or fit or teammates or things like that. Was that simply a matter of complexity, where it was sort of diminishing returns to try and deal with all of that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's partly. I mean, and you know, I know we'll kind of talk later about. What do you do for a model that's kind of predictive versus explanatory, and one you kind of want to show to the public versus one where, hey, I'm just kind of betting on on the NBA or whatever. And we wanted something that really is, like I said, kind of what you see is what you get. So, I mean, there are a lot of adjustments you could make. Certainly if you're looking at team projections, right now we're making the assumption that you can kind of add guys as individual plus-minus projection together and get a team projection. That's probably not ideal, right? You'd want to think about is there enough usage rate on this team or too much, for example. Think about how the team is balanced out, and we don't do that, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we kind of say in the FAQ, hey, this is fun. It's a good way to explore things. I think sometimes it has insights about teams that have added by subtracting or teams that are very old or very young. But there have to be more sophisticated ways to think about, I was going to say team chemistry, but, you know, I'm sure a lot of it is fairly measurable in terms of your balance of scoring versus other skills on the roster.
Go ahead.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, there are definitely things where I think we might adjust and tweak things down the line. But a lot of the time I found that getting the basics right is 97% of the battle. And in this case, if it can make it much more transparent and much more easy to explain, and then you can kind of use that as a jumping off point and saying, you know what, it probably is high or low on this or that player for this reason, right? Because it's not thinking about, how good Derrick Rose was before 3 years ago, because it only looks at the last 3 years of data, for example, right? Or it's not thinking about, this team might look good on paper, but they have no floor spacing. But if you have like a solid baseline that you understand, I think that's sometimes better than being stuck in between where you're making a lot of adjustments for things and you kind of lose explanatory power, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, totally. I think one of the things that I would love personally to see more of is when you and us in the basketball analytic community, when we're talking about these things like a plus minus rating, that we're clarifying it as an estimation and not as like a perfect picture of a player's value. And I think there's I think some of the resistance from fans who are sort of not interested in analytics is not understanding that piece of these numbers being estimations and starting places, and that there are places where your basketball knowledge and your understanding of context can sort of, you know, inform a number that might be too high or too low or things like that.
Yeah, that's the thing too, is in baseball, you kind of project a player's component stats and then add them up and you have WAR or whatever, although that process is a little bit cloudy that people acknowledge. It's still relatively straightforward, whereas we're still not totally sure how to value basketball players exactly, right? Carmelo uses a combination of real plus minus or RPM and box score plus minus or BPM, right? But any of these stats are fraught with a certain amount of uncertainty, and they all have their methodological quirks and challenges and stuff like that. So it's another reason to be fairly humble about these projections, is that, you know, it's one thing to say a guy is going to improve, but another thing to say how good he was in the first place is obviously that question sounds, it's a more fraught question in basketball than in baseball probably.
Which is why it seems like such an important step to include confidence intervals, you know, in the displays and have them right on the graphs for people. And I don't know if that would, I don't know if that will, pardon the wordplay here, but I don't know if that will sort of decrease people's confidence in the projection, seeing that it's sort of, you know, a bar of possibility. But it seems like that's a good step towards acknowledging that, you know, that these are sort of a starting point for measuring player value.
Yeah, it should be a starting point, right? And, you know, I don't know. I mean, the more we can kind of move away from the clairvoyant kind of crystal ball notion of prediction to the, hey, here's a blueprint for how things can go. And sometimes it's intuitive. I mean, you do see, for example, Andrew Wiggins, a guy we've written about somewhat skeptically at 538. but he has a really wide confidence interval on his forecast, which makes sense intuitively, or injured guys. Paul George has a wide one, for example. So that's kind of interesting to see. You know, but I still kind of think there is room for better advanced statistics. This is kind of dangerous territory, I guess, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, both BPM and RPM are in different ways trying to make inferences from play-by-play or box score data. But some of the player tracking stuff, you would think, you know, it would seem like there has to be some way, especially with the defensive side of the game, to take some of that data and create a new advanced stat that uses more information in a way that's intelligent. But, you know, I don't know. One thing I'd like to hear from you about is it kind of surprises me that there aren't really a lot of other Carmelo-like systems out there, because I know for baseball there are like a dozen decent forecasting models, and for fantasy football there are like lots and lots and lots of people trying to win DraftKings or whatnot. But for basketball there are fewer, which is kind of surprising to me, I guess.
We have a few people at Nylon Calculus who have built win projections, and Nathan Walker and Andrew Johnson and Justin Willard and Nick Restifo all did win projections this year, and they're all based off individual player projections, and they're pretty sophisticated, I think. And actually, Andrew's model is interesting because it ties in some variables from the public sport view data.
Oh, cool. Well, we should have collaborated with you guys then, maybe for next year.
Yeah. Well, his big caveat there is, you know, that this looks really good, and I think his win projections actually won the APBR Forum contest last year. But there's only 2 years of public sport view data, and so he's sort of necessarily working with a much smaller data sample. I know, in terms of sharing them in the beautiful format that you guys have at 538, that's more sort of a matter of resources, of getting all of the, you know, getting all the projections out there in a way that's you know, intuitive for people to access and see and sift through.
Well, there's room to improve on the system, and you know, the advantage of it is that we are looking at history since 1976, and so and not all that wonderful new data is available going back that far, but I'm sure there are kind of hybrid approaches, especially for measuring defense, that could prove to be fruitful potentially.
One of the other things that I was really interested in, and this is full disclosure for anybody who doesn't know, but I do some freelance work for 538, and so I helped out with a few of the preview sections this year. And so we took the Carmelo ratings and we sort of assembled a depth chart for the teams and projected how many minutes each player would play at different positions, and that's what built the win projections. And one of the things that was really interesting to me was that each player had a sort of like a minute cap, where beyond that minute cap, their impact on the team would start to decline. Was that number arrived at by the comparables as well?
Yeah, so you kind of look at the slope between effectiveness per minute and playing time. So when you project a guy's plus-minus rating, this is getting into the weeds a bit, but it's weighted by the number of minutes played by each comparable. And so what happens is that in the NBA, because it's a sport where you get to the long run pretty fast, is that if you have a guy who's a developing player, well, then you learn in the first 20 games of the season whether he's actually made a leap forward or not. If he does, he'll play a lot and be good. And if he doesn't, he'll be a bench warmer and not play very much. But basically, as a result, you have to be very careful about what assumptions you make about playing time. If you force a guy to play 35 minutes a game when comparables haven't. That means you're playing him whether he whether he's good or not, right? You think of it as fatigue too or something. But I think our method, which basically says, hey, it projects how much playing time each player should have. It gives you like a 5% fudge factor. But if you go over that, then it diminishes the player's effectiveness. So that's a way to kind of reward teams with more depth. I think it's one of those hidden factors that helps the Spurs, for example, every year, is they really have, you know, a roster 11, 12, 13 guys deep who can play a little bit, and they have the kind of option value of sorting through that roster and seeing which combinations work well together. I'm not saying that Carmelo is capturing all of that. The Spurs are a team that notoriously outperforms whatever projection you give them, but at least making some step toward rewarding depth. You know, I think people also forget how high the attrition is for even healthy mid-career NBA players. You know, catastrophic and tragic things happen from time to time. And so to assume that a guy is going to play 82 games, 35 minutes a game is pretty foolish.
And the diminishing value on those, so as players sort of exceed the minute cap, is that the same across all players? Does it depend on their comparables, or does it depend on their level of performance? Good players decline, you know, drop off less than bad players.
So it's based on the comparable. So if you have a guy where their projection is more sensitive to playing time, then the player will get punished more if you exceed the recommended limits for playing time. So usually it would be a guy, a guy who's kind of on the dawn or desk of his career, right? Someone who's 32 or 33 years old, for example. There are some guys who turn into Kyle Korver and become very effective, and some guys who that's it for their careers pretty much. And so they're probably a little bit more sensitive to what you do for the playing time. If you assume a guy who's kind of a rotation player all of a sudden becomes a starter, then it'll be pretty punitive most of the time.
Mm-hmm. And so I know that this is not included in the system this year, but as a Pacers fan, I can't help but ask, if you were to factor in positionality as a variable, so like Paul George sliding up and playing power forward this year, just hypothetically, how could that factor into the system?
Yeah, I mean, you could look historically at guys who switch positions and how effective they are when they go from one to the other. So that would definitely be in kind of Carmelo 2.0 kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about team fit. Again, I don't want to say like team chemistry, right? But how those skills translate from one position to another. Although part of it is that kind of positions are becoming so flexible in the NBA nowadays. I almost wonder if kind of the 1 through 5 is the way to think about it or not. But, it's a pretty rich historical data set we have for the NBA. So I think all that stuff is possible to look at down the line.
You touched on this just a little bit, but reflecting back to your work on Pacoda, were there any, other than sort of this general structure, were there any sort of specific lessons that you took from Pacoda and brought to Carmelo?
I mean, I think, part of what's, I mean, a couple. One of it is that Pacoda, I think, is very good for telling stories about players, which if you're doing this for kind of mass journalistic consumption is a helpful thing, you know? So it's a way we kind of see how the sausage is made, and that's helpful. Having some experience with Pacoda helps in various ways with Carmelo, although ironically kind of Carmelo was designed to be a lot simpler than Pacoda. And that kind of reflects partly the fact that, hey, we want to get this product out and see how people like it and what its strengths and weaknesses are. But also, over time, like I said earlier, I've kind of come as a modeling strategy to buy a little bit more into simplicity. At least you kind of start with something simple, both because it's more transparent, because there's less potential for a human error to be introduced when you have a simpler program. And then we'll probably iterate on that over time.
Mm-hmm. So moving away from specifically Carmelo, one of the things I've been really curious about at 538 is sort of balancing all these different balls, these different data journalism balls. And so one of the things is, especially on the sports side, is that you you all are sort of walking two paths at the same time. So you have projects like Carmelo, where you are where you're working with predictive analytics and you're projecting what's going to happen in the future, and then you're also working on storytelling. And so you know what's happening in the major league playoffs, and telling stories about specific players and those sorts of things. So I'm wondering about sort of balancing those two different things and how that works.
I mean, we are always shorthanded and short-staffed. I'm sure you've talked to Neil and stuff, and we always have like more than we can possibly do. The good thing about something like Carmelo is that it allows us to do, I'm talking too much kind of inside baseball strategy here. But when you have a good baseline for something, then you can use that as a basis for storytelling and articles down the line, right? So Tristan Thompson, for example, is a guy who Carmelo does not particularly like. You can run a projection on him and say, he probably shouldn't get this max type deal from the Cavs. In fact, he's probably only worth about half of what he and his agent are demanding, in fact. Mm-hmm. So when you have something like that, then you can use that as a jumping off point. But yeah, I mean, it's a kind of fundamental challenge with data journalism is that it's hard work. if you want to have a high burden of proof and a high burden of rigor, our stuff is really popular, but the average article that we do might run through 4 or 5 or 6 different people. It's not just kind of someone pontificating, which is not to say we never put out mediocre articles. I mean, I think everyone does, right? but at least we aspire to have stories that are both rigorous and well presented and well told, and you can do that. It's just like a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. And where's the line in terms of sort of showing your work? It seems like with sports fans, they're sort of increasingly savvy, increasingly interested in analytics, but there's also a line where the complexity is going to turn some people off or turn some people away. And I think probably the Wiggins article is a great example because, for me, I thought it was sort of very well-reasoned and rational and sort of cautious. But for somebody who is not as familiar with those statistics, it came off as sort of rash and reactionary.
So we deal with this issue all the time, right? I think, first of all, there's a lot of value. If you can show something in a more complicated way or a more simple way, then for journalistic standards, the simple way is a lot better if you come to the same conclusion, right? So a lot of times what I'll do is I'll kind of say, okay, let me do this in a way that I feel is rigorous and kind of actually probably take 4 or 5 different approaches to a problem, because what you want ideally is that whatever result you have is not highly sensitive to your methodology. If it is, then you have a methodology piece and not really a piece about basketball or baseball or whatnot. But once you've kind of done the research yourself, and you don't then necessarily need to write a 3,000-word summary of kind of what your research process was. That's not the story, but then you know you're on solid ground to tell what might be a simpler story. Or the story might be that, hey, this is a complicated problem. That can be a simple story, is to say, hey, everyone else is too sure of themselves here. But I don't know. When I'm writing for the site, I tend to be pretty scrupulous about detail, to the point where I would want people to be able to kind of recreate the methodology, at least for the most part. Sometimes if you're writing things on deadline, then you can't be quite that rigorous. But most of our articles have footnotes and whatnot. A lot of our articles have data that you can download at GitHub or something. Something like Carmelo, we try and show not just the end result, but how things get there. But, I kind of think that transparency is integral to any type of journalism, really, and especially the type of journalism that we do. And it's another one of those things where it's possible to be very, very detail-oriented in describing the methodology, but also have it be readable. That can actually happen. It just takes a long time to write those pieces.
Mm-hmm. Are there some unique challenges with running the sports vertical, whether it be the data or the audience, as opposed to politics or lifestyle or science or some of the other things you guys are tackling?
Yeah, I mean, well, with sports, we get we get a fair amount of our audience from ESPN, from ESPN.com, or if ESPN will often kindly tweet or Facebook something we do or have us on their shows. And when you get, like, the general interest ESPN audience, then the comment section becomes a little bit more skeptical, I guess, shall we say. But, you know, at the same time, I actually think that, sports fans, because they're so used to analytics and because every sports fan is dealing with numbers in some way, shape, or form, right? It's a matter of kind of which stats you're using. People who think Kobe Bryant is still good are studying how many points he scores or whatnot, right? Maybe not a useful stat, but a stat nevertheless. So, you know, unless you anger Timberwolves fans about Andrew Wiggins, then usually debates, I think, are good-natured for the most part.
Well, I won't take up any more of your time, Nate. I know you're really busy. I really appreciate you spending the time and talking through the system. And, yeah, a lot of fun stuff, and excited to see the rest of the previews roll out.
Cool, and thank you for contributing to them. And like I said, I think there's a lot of potential for collaboration maybe down the line to make Carmelo even more interesting.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot.